Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning, friends. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here, and welcome to your Wednesday, June 7th. It is June 7th, and I think it's Prince's birthday today. He's finally catching up in age. He's a celebrated celebrity here from the Twin Cities. Uh-oh. And he is 59 today, if he were alive. Of course, we lost him in the last couple of years. And we are off to a great start this morning. A little bit of squeakiness. I don't know what that is. Anyway, there is a very interesting story that I caught my attention right away out of Maple Grove, Minnesota. And this is a very smart bus driver who started a reading program on his bus. How cool is that? He challenged the students. His name is Perry May. He challenged the students on his bus to read books on the way to school. The move was designed to keep calm on a noisy bus. Now, more than 25 kids have read almost 115 books this year. The kindergartners pair with older students to help them read harder words. How neat is that? All right, we're going to talk about understanding and seeing Jesus in Jewish festivals. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk to our friend Ryan Karp from Chosen People Ministries. Be back in a minute. So nice to have you with us today. I have in studio a guest from Chosen People Ministries, Ryan Karp. He's the Chicago Branch and Ministries Director, and he's in town speaking. And I thought I would nab him, and we could have some discussion about Jewish holidays and how Jewish people worship and where Jesus and how Jesus can be found in those Jewish holidays, as well as Pentecost. So we've got lots to talk about. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And nice to have you here. Now, you're from the Chicago area, and but you have you're a missionary, so you've got a nonstop passion to help reach the lost for Christ, especially Jewish people.
If you ask my wife, what she would tell you is, if I know there's a Jewish person in the room, all I'm doing is thinking about how I can share with them, or how the Lord might open up a door, and how I can pray to just talk with them about the Lord, about Messiah, about Jesus.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this in the studio earlier today. I always have this interest in reaching people where they're at, whether they're Jewish or Muslim. So I always want more tools. I want to be better equipped. And, of course, I have to show up with the love of Jesus to even get the attention of somebody. But let's talk about Pentecost, because you just were talking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Pentecost Sunday came just recently. And so a lot of people don't know that Pentecost is actually not a Christian holiday. At least it wasn't. It was mm-hmm. really just the Greek word for a Jewish holiday called Shavuot. Shavuot was the Feast of Weeks, originally prescribed in Leviticus chapter 23, and that the reason that there were so many people in Jerusalem during Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 was because this was a pilgrimage feast that Jewish devout men had to attend. Mm-hmm. They had to go up to Jerusalem for.
So this idea of looking and finding Jesus in Jewish holidays, this is something I'm fascinated by, and I want to know more about how we go about doing that.
Well, it's actually not as hard as you think. I mean, what you have to do is realize that the Bible is one entire unit and is not separate stories. And this amazing chapter that people don't read unless they have well-worn pages in the book of Leviticus, Leviticus 23 lays out this calendar year for the life of a Jewish religious person in the Bible. And the thing is, if you go through the calendar and you also look at how Jesus's last week and the life of Jesus unfolded, you start to see that things happened on very specific days. For instance, Jesus was crucified at Passover. Passover commemorated the time when the lamb during the 10th plague in Egypt was slaughtered, and you covered your lintel and doorpost of your house when you were a slave in Egypt with its blood, and the Lord would pass over you. If he saw the blood of the perfect lamb, then you would go from slavery to freedom. Well, it's very similar with Jesus, because Jesus was called the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Pontius Pilate even said he was innocent or guilt-free. And if we apply the blood of his sacrifice on the doorposts and lintels of our hearts, then God will pass over us. even though we deserve judgment because of our sin. And if he does that, then we go from slavery and sin to freedom in Jesus.
The New Testament points to these holidays, doesn't
it? Oh, totally, totally. So one other cool, really cool example. There's a holiday called First Fruits that happened on the Sunday right after Passover began. That happens every single year according to the book of Leviticus. And so what happens is you wave your first fruit offering to the Lord, acknowledging that he's the one who brought it and he's the one who's going to bring the fruit after it. Well, something very specific happened on the Sunday after Jesus was crucified during that week of Passover. Well, he rose from the dead. And 1 Corinthians calls him the first fruits of the resurrection, because we acknowledge that the Lord is the one who raised him from the dead, and he will raise us from the dead after that.
There's a lot of heads nodding yes in the studio right now as I'm looking around. It's a great insight. So let's talk about the spring holidays and the fall holidays. This is what's the difference?
Okay, well, that's perfect. In the book of Leviticus, once again, the spring holidays and the fall holidays are separated by what would have been the agricultural harvest time. And you first have Passover and unleavened bread, followed by first fruits, which we briefly spoke about. Mm-hmm. And then the last spring holiday is called Shavuot, or the Feast of Weeks, W-E-E-K-S. We call it Pentecost because penta, derivative of the number 5, it's 50 days after that time period between Passover and first fruits. But what happened in Jewish theology is that this was the day that God gave the law at Mount Sinai, where he literally etched his guidelines for this people that he was betrothing himself to so that they could be holy like he was holy. Well, it was on this same day that the disciples were gathered in Jerusalem. They were waiting for the promise that Jesus talks about in Acts chapter 1, and all of a sudden, God puts his spirit inside of them and sort of etches himself onto their hearts as opposed to etching himself onto stone tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just incredible, and it's not a coincidence. So at that point, you have the end of the spring holidays, and you have the harvest time. Well, Jesus also said, as he looked over a crowd that he had compassion on, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. And the fall holidays have not been sort of fulfilled, as it were, in the work of Jesus or the work of the Lord yet. So the way I see it is that if you have been sealed in Jesus by the Holy Spirit, then we as believers in Jesus are in the harvest, and it is our job as laborers in the harvest to make sure that other people know that they can have hope in Jesus.
And that's how the fall holidays would be fulfilled.
Well, the fall holidays will be fulfilled when I believe the Lord comes back, because the first fall holiday is the Feast of Trumpets.
Okay.
And in the New Testament, there are many, many places where all of a sudden you see loud trumpets blaring, and we get this idea that either it's the return of Christ or the resurrection of the dead.
Uh-huh.
So at the very least, we have something miraculous happening. But the problem is when that happens, it may be too late for a lot of people to turn to Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, this is an interesting discussion. I'm starting to get very interested in your own personal story, too, and I want to get into that because I think we're all interested in knowing how we can understand someone from a Jewish background, how we can be sensitive to their upbringing and their traditions, and yet we want to share about the great news of the Messiah. So we'll take a short break, and we come back more with Ryan Karp from Chosen People Ministries in just a minute. Welcome back to the program. I know, like me, you're enjoying this discussion I'm having with Ryan Karp from Chosen People Ministries. And if you just joined us, we're talking about the Jewish holidays and how we can see Jesus in all of them. And so far, Ryan, I am fascinated by what you've said. A lot of Christians, when they start reading like the Bible through in a year, they get to Leviticus, and boy, that's where things stop.
Yeah.
And Leviticus 23 pretty much lays out all the holidays, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Okay, now I'm real curious about the way you were raised and how you came to know Jesus as the Messiah and your Savior.
Yeah, well, I was raised in a mixed marriage household, which means I had one Jewish parent, one non-Jewish parent, which according to the Pew Research survey from a few years ago is actually more common than not in Jewish sort of life and Jewish marriage that there would be mixed marriage. But I grew up sort of irreligious. One side had a Christian background, one side Jewish background, which means that December was amazing in my house because I had Hanukkah.
You got it all, didn't you?
Absolutely, and Christmas. But my father was invited by a Christian friend to a church, and he had never been to a church really before. And that morning he heard about Jesus and Passover and how they work together. And a Jewish man gave his heart to the Lord that morning.
Wow.
But it wasn't my dad. It was a different guy.
Oh, you suckered me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My dad ran up front and started yelling at the guy.
Oh, no.
So it took about 3 months in the days before Google. My father researched to prove him wrong and realized he couldn't, and that Jesus was the Messiah that our people had been waiting for. I came to faith a year and a half later after watching a Christian cartoon, which is really cool because I was showing my son the same cartoon a few weeks ago, who's only three, and he was learning about Jesus. But fast forward a little bit. I came to faith at the age of 10, but my faith didn't mean much until I was 19. And I went on this trip to Israel with a bunch of Jewish students in college. And about 4 days in, I offered that I believed in Jesus. And their response was to kick me off the trip.
Wow.
When I got back home, my father asked, "Are you angry at them?" And I said, "Dad, they're not them, they're us." And I said, my heart broke for my people. It connected me more to them than ever before. And, you know, I hope that the listeners, maybe by seeing how interconnected the Bible is with the Jewish sort of holidays and Jesus, maybe they get their hearts broken like my heart is broken. I determined to be able to relevantly share the gospel with my Jewish people. And so I went to Bible school and seminary, and I've been in D.C., New York, Philadelphia. And it was that burning bush experience of being kicked off a trip because Jesus was a no-no to Jewish people that absolutely broke my heart. And I hope to break other people's hearts, and maybe someone will be like my dad's Christian colleague and invite their Jewish friend to church or talk to them, even though it might be uncomfortable.
Yeah. How uncomfortable is it now for you to be in Jewish circles where you're always up against opposition because you're the outsider still? You're the rebel. You're the rogue.
Yeah, well, sometimes I'm against opposition, but other times a lot of Jewish people are secular or just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So there are times when it's wonderful and it's easy to talk, and there are times when I'm just dismissed, you know, offhand because he's one of them. He's no longer Jewish. It's crazy. He's one of these crazy people. But I have so much confidence in who I am in the Lord at this point, and that's one of the ways I've grown, that it's okay to be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah, well said, Ryan. It's really okay to be uncomfortable, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's part of the whole process.
And if they don't hear, then how will they ever receive?
Uh-huh. Is it helpful for Christians to better understand Jewish traditions and cultures in order to have more relationship with them, or do Jewish people not expect Christians to have much understanding?
It's absolutely 100% helpful for Jewish people to understand Jewish traditions, not only because it helps them engage with their Jewish friends, because it helps them enhance their understanding of Scripture, and it shows that the Bible truly does work together better than any book that a mortal man could put together. In fact, my wife is not Jewish, and you know, some people think that, well, Jewish people are better or more loved by God, and I think the Bible does not say that, actually. But when she realized that sometimes it's easier to talk to a Jewish person about faith in Jesus when you're not Jewish, she started to really embrace that more. Because, well, of course you're a Gentile. Of course you believe in Jesus. You know, you're a Christian. So why can't I talk to you about it? You're not a threat. Whereas I, who identify as a Jewish person and say I believe in Jesus, I'm automatically a threat. So my wife, by understanding the Jewish traditions, and by the way, we were married under a chuppah, like our son had a circumcision, like we're Jewish to the core. We don't eat leaven for Passover. But she can relate to these Jewish women that she's meeting with kids as she goes out with our kids. And so it helps her to relate about Jesus, and it also enhances her faith. So I encourage others to do the same thing. Explore it.
Yeah. Ryan, tell me more about your work. Tell me more about Chosen People Ministries and what you do, and you work with kids as well as adults, and you're the national director of Young Adult Mobilization and Outreach.
Yeah, well, I try to encourage a lot of people in a lot of different things, whether it's kids work and camp work, or whether it's campus work, which is a horribly underreached group of people. So Chosen People Ministries has been around since 1894. We're the largest mission-reaching Jewish people around the world, 17 different countries. Wherever you have large Jewish populations, that's where we are. Our United States headquarters is in New York City. And in Chicago, what I do is I lead Bible studies. I meet with people individually. I encourage and oversee other missionaries in the area doing Russian outreach. We do kids camping ministries on the East Coast, and we're starting some kids ministries in the Midwest. We do big Passover outreaches in this little building downtown that used to be called the Sears Tower.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, but I mean, it's incredible when you're overlooking Lake Michigan and you're sitting at a plate of filet mignon surrounded by Christians and their Jewish friends, and I'm there to tell them about Jesus through Passover.
Wow.
I just think it's incredible, and they're paying a pretty penny to be there, and it's a good date night too, by the way.
Yeah.
But stuff like that is just primo. I mean, because when you work through Christians, when you can help Christians share with their Jewish friends, kind of like my father was shared with, it's incredible. So I do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Where do Christians fail when it comes to sharing their faith with Jewish people?
I don't know that I like to say it in
fail,
such a way.
Fail's not the right word.
It's strong word.
Yeah, it's a strong word, but where do we blow it most often?
Often I think Christians can become intimidated, either because of the history of anti-Semitism that the Jewish people have experienced, or they feel like, well, Jewish people have enough trouble, or maybe they think that Jewish people are incredibly successful and so they don't need it, which, by the way, is a stereotype that has perpetrated anti-Semitism for a long time.
Uh-huh.
But they become intimidated, or they say, I don't know enough. One of the biggest fallacies is that Jewish people know everything about Judaism and are very devout.
Ah.
Most Jewish people are not devout whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Most Jewish people don't know much about the Bible, and I guarantee you many Christians know more than most Jewish people about the Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
So when you can help educate them in a very kind and loving way, of course, you don't need to be intimidated because they're just people like anybody else, even more so.
Yeah, yeah. And do you find that there's a hunger right now, more so than usual in the Jewish community, for spiritual connectedness? Or is business up at the synagogues, or what?
There are always ebbs and flows in religiosity, and that's not just with Jewish people, of course. In the 70s, it was the Jesus movement. A lot of Jewish people came to faith. In the 80s and early 90s, it was after Perestroika and after the wall fell. A lot of Russian and former Soviet Jewish people were coming to faith, whether it was in Australia, Israel, or New York City, or Germany. And now we're seeing a lot of younger Jewish people who are willing to engage because almost of their lack of Jewish tradition, because they were growing up probably with barely any Jewish tradition except knowing that their heritage was Jewish. And in Israel specifically, Jewish people are just incredibly open to talk about whatever, unless you're talking to religious people.
Yeah.
Because in Israel, by and large, the population is secular or maybe a little bit traditional, but not religious.
Yeah. So we've got about a minute left, Ryan, and here I have a Jew in my studio with his Bible open. Do share something.
Let me share a little bit from the book of Romans. A lot of people skip over this because it doesn't make sense in their understanding of the book of Romans, but Paul gives his heart, I believe, even though he was called an apostle to the Gentiles, meaning he was sent specifically to non-Jewish people. He went to the synagogue where he visited every city.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he went first because his passion was so strong. In Romans chapter 11, Paul says this, I say then, has God cast away his people? Certainly not, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham of the tribe of Benjamin. Paul's a believer in Jesus. He's still Jewish. But if you go down to verse 11 of Romans 11, I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not. But through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles. In other words, this is almost like an omission of the great commission.
Mm-hmm.
We forget that by non-Jewish people accepting Jesus and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who they never knew, technically, because they were pagans, now they have the privilege of what the later verses actually say is to make Jewish people jealous. And I mean that in a completely godly, loving, fantastic way.
Right.
You have the Jewish God. You have the Holy Spirit. You have the Spirit that lived in King David. And now you have this tremendous privilege. In verse 13, it says, for I speak to you Gentiles inasmuch as I'm an apostle to the Gentiles. I magnify my ministry if by any means I may provoke to jealousy those who are my flesh and save some of them.
Hmm.
It's Christians' duty, according to the Apostle Paul, to share the gospel with Jewish people because they have received the gospel, so they can turn around and give it back to the original messengers, 99% of whom do not believe that Jesus is their Messiah.
Wow. Ryan, thank you so much for coming into the studio, and blessings on your ministry and your speaking opportunities that you've got coming up this week here in Minneapolis. We are just delighted that you could make it. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. And if you want help reaching Jewish people, we have people in the area that can help you.
That is awesome. And we're going to put that up on the website. Chosen People Ministries. Is it chosenpeopleministries.com?
Chosenpeople.com.
Chosenpeople.com. We'll take a short break and be right back. Good morning, half past the hour. We're going to go to news, and after that, we're going to talk to Dr. Kent Kaiser. Talk about all the news of the day. We'll be back in just a minute. Good morning. 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Jesus said, "Whatever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me." Mike Slaughter, pastor and author of The Christian Wallet, reminds us that we are called to give our resources to help others.
We are God's provision in the world. It often frustrates me, especially when I'm working in Sudan and we see such tragedy and children, 1 in 5 children, die of hunger or unsafe water, unclean water. And people say, if God's a loving God, why does God allow that to happen? It's not God's problem. We allow that to happen because Jesus said, the things I do, you will do, and even greater things than these. So as I often say, we're the only bank account that God has.
If you want to hear that full interview, you can do that on our website, myfaithradio.com. Search Christian Wallet. It will take you right to where you want to go. Mike Slaughter is the pastor and author and the person that you just heard. It is 25 minutes until the top of the hour. In studio right now, I have Dr. Kent Kaiser, chair of communications here at the University of Northwestern. We'll be back with him in just a minute.
People fight to control words, often ruthlessly, simply because words have the power to influence. This is Jim Garlow. Today, the words terror, choice, marriage, or family stir reactions. It's true, isn't it, that God did not send his justice or his authority or his knowledge or even his peace to save the world. It was the Word that became flesh and dwelt among us. It was the Word that revealed God to us. It is words that reveal him now. On October the 31st, 1517, a Roman Catholic priest posted 2,717 words on the door of the church in Wittenberg, Germany. Mere words, but they mattered a great deal. The priest was Martin Luther. The document was the 95 Theses, a thesis that ignited a Reformation that shook the foundations of Western society in the Protestant Reformation that followed. Martin Luther's words had power. Your words have power. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Minutes until the top of the hour. Good morning. So glad you're listening today. I have Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio. He's the chair of communications here at the University of Northwestern, but he's on summer vacation, so he's barefoot. Surprised I let him in the studio today. Kent, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. All right. Let's. We got a lot to cover today. Where should we start?
Well, I think that, first of all, I wanted to thank listeners who called Senator Franken's office last week. We asked the people call his office, and it seems like it worked. He was planning to do an event in California with Kathy Griffin, the comic who had held up a mask of President Trump, a bloodied mask, and thought that this was somehow funny, showing President Trump beheaded. And he was defending her, Al Franken was, and he was planning to do this event with Griffin out there in California on July 7th, and we had many people call in, and he said, Al Franken said the very next day that he got so many calls that he decided to cancel the event with Kathy Griffin. So it shows that that kind of grassroots activism actually does work. It's disappointing that he wasn't astute enough in the first place to decide on his own to break ties with her, that he didn't. And it's too bad that he sat there and defended her for a couple of days before he made that decision to cancel the event. But at least he came around to the right decision in the end. It was interesting, too, just even more recently, Al Franken was supposed to be doing an interview with the comedian Bill Maher on his show. And Franken pulled out of that interview very quickly after Maher expressed a racial slur, used the N-word on the air. And Al Franken didn't have to think one bit about dumping that interview from his schedule, and it's interesting to see like how quickly that happened, and whether his you have to wonder whether his recent his recent experience with Kathy Griffin had anything to do with that, that he just really knew he'd better get out of that interview with Bill Maher quickly before he got more calls or what. Personally, I think that the Bill Maher slur was less shocking, less you know, something less than the Kathy Griffin's affront, and yet he was very quick to get out of it. I mean, certainly it's a bad word to use, but Maher was using the word in reference to himself, and personally, I didn't think it rose to quite the level of Kathy Griffin's affront to morality, but... And nevertheless, Franken got out of that interview with Bill Maher very quickly, and that's probably a good thing, too.
Seems like there's a lot of explosive anger nowadays out there.
I think that's right. I think you know, it's interesting to see how people try and defend free speech. And you know, free speech is great, but it doesn't mean you have to be associated with bad speech. I mean, you have that choice. And, I mean, I'm glad that Al Franken finally decided not to be associated with Kathy Griffin, but it's unfortunate it took us calling in for that to happen, but that's how it was.
Well, Ken, I don't know if you saw this, but CNN has a man, Reza Aslan, who's got a spiritual show on CNN, talks about people's faith and spirituality, and of course he tweeted a horrifically bad remark towards President Trump. And then, of course, he came out and apologized, saying, I don't use that kind of language. And then when you go through his history of tweets, not only does he use that kind of language, but he uses language even worse than that.
Right.
And here's a guy with a show on spirituality and faith on CNN.
Right.
Which is probably how he got the job.
could be. Personally, I don't watch CNN. No surprise there. But I think that the language has just gone over the top, and it's... You know, sometimes you sit there and read something, and it's easy to just consume media and consume the language and not think much of it. But I'm one of those people who thinks pretty carefully about the words, and students will kind of actually laugh at me for how I parse people's language and look at the individual words that they use. But I think words have meaning, and unfortunately, people become dull to the harsh words that are used oftentimes in social media, and I think we got to be vigilant about that.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's bounce around just a little bit. I found this interesting, as you did, that trap shooting is exploding as a high school sport.
Yeah, trap shooting is awesome, first of all.
I knew there was a reason you wanted to talk about this.
As a Second Amendment enthusiast, but it is interesting, there was an article recently in one of the papers here in Minnesota that was talking about how trap shooting is the fastest growing sport. Now, it's not a sport that's actually endorsed by the Minnesota State High School League. It's more of a club, I guess you would call it, than a sport, although the students who are in it all call it a sport. But there were 900 more participants just in the last year. And by the way, there are now more participants in trap shooting in Minnesota than there are participants in hockey. This is the state of hockey, and there are more participants in these clubs in high schools for trap shooting. Again, I love hockey too, but this is just awesome. These are like the two most popular sports.
You can't spring these statistics on me. You have to give me these stats in advance of the interview. You can't just spring this on me on the air.
I know, you can't believe it, but it's true. But I think it's great. It's a great sport. It's kind of funny, though. You know, I come from the academic world where we study sport communication, and I don't see anybody else like me who's an academic in sports really cheering on the trap shooting. I mean, it's very interesting, especially like I've done a lot of research on gender in sports, and I don't see my counterparts at other schools who are out there cheering for women's sports. I do not see them getting behind this, and yet here you have a sport where the boys and the girls compete together against one another. The girls are just as likely to do. In fact, they're actually usually a better shot. So they're usually doing as well or better than the boys are. It's a sport where people with disabilities can participate. I mean, basically, you just need to shoot a gun. You can be in a wheelchair and actually do very well in trap shooting. And it's just a fun sport. You know, you'll have kids come out there and they have 25 shots, okay, and some will shoot all 25 clays and some will shoot seven. And they're just out there having a lot of fun. And it's an integrated sport for boys and girls. And I just think it's not celebrated enough. But, of course, it involves guns, which it's got to be. This has got to create real cognitive dissonance for any liberal who is supportive of gender equality in sports and that. Because on the one hand, they want to support that gender equality. But on the other hand, they don't want to support guns. Well, I don't have that cognitive dissonance because I want the gender equality in sports and I love guns. So this is awesome. You
know? And how do you feel about killing a clay pigeon?
Oh, they should all go down. They're all going to crack one way or another. Whether you shoot them in the air, whether they hit the ground. So, you know. Yeah.
All right. I think it's time to reset. We'll take a little break. When we come back, more with Dr. Kent Kaiser, the Barefooted Kent, in just a minute. It is 14 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here in studio with Dr. Kent Kaiser. We're talking about a number of things. We're kind of all over the map right now. But let's talk about the Democrats and their agenda or lack thereof. They need to reset and figure out what their new mission is.
Well, everybody on the every liberal pundit is saying this, that the Democrats don't really have an agenda, that they are still reeling after the last election. And actually, if you look back to that last election, they didn't have much of an agenda. And that's part of why they lost. If you look at Hillary Clinton's agenda, it was really free of issues. It was her reason for wanting to be president. Every time, I mean, you hear about it from people behind the scenes, every time people would ask her, why are you running? Her response was that it was her turn. Well, it wasn't that she wanted to do any particular thing for America, but that she just wanted to be president because it was her turn. Well, that doesn't make much sense. And the person who, whether you like it or not, the person who's at the top of the ticket running for president is the one who sort of sets the agenda for the party. Mm-hmm. You know, the party might have its platform and that, but honestly, the person who's running for president is the one who's actually setting the policy agenda. And so, unfortunately, Democrats came through that next election without an agenda. And unfortunately for them today, they still haven't formulated a good agenda. They have a lot of disarray on their side as to exactly what they want to do. And, of course, it's difficult to get an agenda, to give any kind of legs to an agenda when you don't have a majority in either the state, the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate. And, of course, they don't have the presidency. So now, on the other side, on the Republican side, they don't seem to be able to get their act together either. And it's probably a good thing for the Republicans. The Democrats are in such disarray.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very much disappointed with the Republicans at this point for not having passed any major legislation. We haven't heard of anything coming out of this Congress, and it's nuts when you think about the fact that there's a Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican President. There should be all kinds of good stuff coming out of that.
Now we're starting to wind them up a little.
I know. Here we go.
Now we're talking. Here we go.
But, no, seriously, remember, the health care bill was defeated or pulled back, and now they're talking about maybe not getting a health care bill through before maybe the 4th of July, before the end of this. Well, if we start pushing that off till next year, then they're not going to want to move on it at all. You have to get the hard stuff done early. It should have all been done already, as far as I'm concerned. But when something like health care is big, it's hard. It's hard to explain. It's going to have an impact on people. You want to get that kind of stuff done well before an election. And here we are, you know, pushing this off. If they don't get something passed before like the beginning of August, then I don't see them actually doing it because they'll be too afraid to after that.
Mm-hmm. Here's a line from an article, and it was from the Charlotte Observer. And I think your point is well taken. It says that if the closer you get to an election is a day that it gets harder to do the tough stuff.
It's true.
So as it gets closer and closer to an election, they start to retreat.
But, gee, they haven't even done the easy stuff to me. Remember during the campaign, Trump talked about repealing the Johnson Amendment. The Johnson Amendment is the one that basically gets tacked on to, you know, it gets renewed all the time. And it's an amendment that prevents religious leaders from talking about politics from the pulpit, for example. Mm-hmm. It's the one that prevents religious organizations from other organizations from talking about politics, endorsing candidates. So it's not just churches, but for fear of losing their tax-exempt status. And Trump talked during the campaign about repealing the Johnson Amendment, which should be done. And that should be easy.
Mm-hmm.
How hard could that possibly be to repeal something? It's not even like building something new. It's just, you know what I mean? All you have to do is repeal it. You don't even have to build something new.
Just repeal it.
We know what's written. Repeal it. You know?
Yeah.
But there's other bills like that where, or other ideas, that policy ideas that came up during the campaign that just have not moved anywhere in this Congress. And yeah, I'm really kind of at a loss for it. I understand them being a little skittish about tinkering with health care. But again, we've talked about it before. How do you go for 7 or 8 years griping about Obamacare and then not have an alternative in place, ready to go day one when you get the majority of mm-hmm. both the U.S. Senate and the House and you have the presidency? It's stupid.
Yeah. And of course, I've heard things like Mitch McConnell saying it looks harder and harder to repeal and replace.
Right. And so it's almost just, yeah, it's really, I don't disagree that it's probably hard. And I mean, I suspect that part of the difficulty for them is that there are actually members of Congress who want to just repeal Obamacare and not replace it with anything. But they have to, there's a political reality that there are some things that people liked about Obamacare that probably need to stay in place. And the president even talked about those things during the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So fine, make that happen. There were things like pre-existing conditions mm-hmm. and not being, you know, disallowed insurance because you had a pre-existing condition. People also like the idea of being able to keep their kids on their insurance until they're age 26 or whatever it is. So keep those good things that people like, but and the other things that don't make sense. I mean, you know, if we otherwise, what we're just going to have is this system continue on and sort of implode or require a lot more money. We've seen how the premiums have gone up, up, up. The burden on employers. The big untold story, I think, with it is the number of employers who opt to hire people only part-time rather than having full-time positions, because as soon as you hit a certain percent, 70% or something like time. So if somebody's close to full time, then you have to give them health care mm-hmm. as an employer. And so many employers have held back on hiring full time employees and they just hire a couple part time employees instead. Well, this isn't good for employees and it's not helpful to the businesses. That's an example. This is why Obamacare needs to be repealed and, you know, replaced with something else that doesn't include those bad things.
Mm-hmm.
So how hard could it be, really? I mean,
yeah.
The Congress really, I mean, they just need to realize that something needs to be replacing Obamacare and get it done.
Right. All right, Ken, I want to talk about immigration a little bit because you had some very interesting thoughts on that during the break. Would you share those?
Well, if you look back at immigration to our country over the last 100 years, it's usually been the case that it's Christians who are immigrating to our country. Last year was the first time in about 15 years about 15 years ago, we had a huge influx of Somalians while that nation was just ravaged. And so we had a large number of Muslims come into our country that year. Last year, it was about 46% of the people coming to the country were Muslims. Only about 44% were Christians. If you look at what's going on in the Middle East, this is slightly similar or a related topic. If you look at the Middle East over the last 100 years, 100 years ago, about 13% of the population in the Middle East was Christian. And if we keep the trajectory we're on today, now Christianity has bloomed all over the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the Middle East, in a couple of years, the population they expect to be only about 3% Christian. Now, those people are to some extent being killed, and that's for sure. But it's not like that kind of numbers. What's happening is those people are leaving the Middle East. There are actually now more Arab Middle Eastern Christians who are no longer in the Middle East than there are in the Middle East. So they've moved to Europe, they've moved to the United States, they've moved to other countries. But so I think that's a very interesting thing, that there are actually more Arab Christians not in the Middle East.
Wow.
Yeah. And it seems to me, and here's what's really different about that kind of immigration, by the way, is that when you've got immigration that's from many of these countries, what's happening is that they are actually processed abroad. It's not like other immigrations where people show up on the doorstep and then they're processed here. These are processed abroad, and so the religious question is actually asked in the application for immigration. That's how we know what religion they are. And by the way, very few are atheist or non-affiliated. Mm-hmm. It's tiny, tiny, tiny percent. And so they're usually either Muslim or Christian, and then there's a few people who try to come in who are Hindu or Buddhist or something like that, but it's a much, much smaller number again. So we know who they are when they're abroad and they're planning to come into our country. Wouldn't you think that our country would, you know, really try to bring in the Christians, because they're the ones who are being persecuted? When it comes to the Muslims, it's what's happening is that you've got their different sects who are actually fighting one another. So you've got the Sunni and Shia Muslims who are fighting one another over there in their countries. Meanwhile, the Christians are actually being killed just for being Christians.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't you think that our country would be the one that would want to flag, you know, who are the Christians, bring those in, give them priority, because they're the ones who are actually just being persecuted because of their religion. It's not just because there's some disagreement among, you know, the sects of mm-hmm. Christianity or something,
yeah.
But they just want to exterminate Christians altogether, and it's disturbing. They need our prayers, of course, but also from a policy perspective, we ought to have an eye toward bringing in the people who are truly being Christians, who are being persecuted just for being Christians.
Mm-hmm. Once again, brilliant analysis from a barefooted professor on summer vacation. Kent, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'll see you next week.
Thanks.
All right, a couple minutes until the top of the hour. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll be back with Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. He has really got some interesting stuff to tell us today, so stay tuned. Be back in a minute. It is almost top of the hour. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. Faith and success. It's not the amount or quality of your faith that indicates success for a Christian in business. It's all about faithfulness to God. It's going to be a great conversation. Stay tuned. Bill Arnold here with you. I'll be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.